Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Cats.
Let me tell you a story. August 1911. Olalla, Washington. It's beautiful out here. You can hear the ocean waves lapping lazily against the rocky shore from the porch of this rustic home tucked neatly away among the trees.
It's the Pacific Northwest Wilderness. That's where the property gets its namesake, Wilderness Heights. But this house will come to be known by another name, Starvation Heights.
This property is advertised as a medical facility where people from all over the world who can't be cured by traditional mainstream medicine are welcomed with open arms, where they're promised the healing and relief they seek from their new doctors.
The truth is so far from this promise that it's hard to fathom. This place is more prison than infirmary, more gulag than hospital. Patients here receive a treatment course of beatings, torture, and starvation. Many have already died.
Well, today it comes to an end. Police enter the facility, horrified, shocked, and nauseated by what they see. Patients are gaunt and confused, their faces gazing with empty, thousand-yard stares. Their skeletal bodies are emaciated and on the brink of death.
Cautiously, the police walk through. They are determined to fulfill their assigned mission today before it's too late. Finally arrest and bring to justice the deranged doctor who's in charge.
What doctor would do something like this anyway? What medical professional would endorse this kind of extreme, dangerous, abusive treatment? No one. The woman at the center of this is not a doctor. Not even a real medical professional of any kind.
She's a charlatan and a swindler. And these, well, these aren't the last lives she'll take.
At the back of the compound, they see their mark. Her name is Linda Hazard, and she is nothing short of a monster.
Hazard's alternative treatments include beatings, psychological torture, and most famously, extreme starvation. In total, 18 of her patients are confirmed to have died during her reign of terror in the Pacific Northwest. But experts say that the true number could be as high as 40. 40 people who were starved to death by a woman they trusted to handle their medical decisions. 40 people robbed by that same woman. A woman who was seen wearing the jewelry and clothes of her deceased patients, sometimes just hours after their deaths.
But the strangest part of Linda Hazard's story isn't her callousness. We've seen plenty of sociopaths and mayhem on the show. The strangest part is how she seemed to genuinely believe her own lies. She was a charlatan, a fraud who never held an actual medical license. And for some reason, people continued seeking her out, even after her actions were exposed to the public. She continued for years, just as she had before, until she eventually treated her last patient. Herself.
Was she simply misguided? Or was she truly a cold-blooded murderer? We'll get to that. But right now, all you need to know is that Linda Hazard needs a lawyer. A good one.
History happened. The good, bad, the ugly. This is the underside of history. The lesser-known pieces lost in the bigger picture of time. From the creators of Myths and Legends and from Cast Media, this is Scoundrel. History's Forgotten Villains, We're Jason and Carissa Weiser.
Join us every episode as we explore the dark, quirky, and bizarre history that you might not have heard before, but really should.
Linda Laura Burfield is born in Carver County, Minnesota in 1867. One of eight children in a wealthy family headed by her father, Montgomery Burfield. She leads an idyllic childhood, but one marred by illness.
Linda has suffered from intestinal issues and stomach-related pain for most of her childhood, and well into adulthood. Often for days at a time, Linda is confined to her bed, unable to stand and live like the rest of her family because of these issues. And the worst part is, there seems to be no cure. The only thing that helps even a little with her pain and symptoms is the occasional enema.
Her father, Montgomery, cares deeply for his children's health and well-being, and he calls a doctor to the house for regular checkups. Later on, Linda will think back to this visiting doctor and the odd blue pill he used to give all the kids.
We don't know much about this blue pill and its contents, but it plays a significant part in young Linda's life, especially in shaping some problematic thought patterns. You see, after taking the medicine, she becomes convinced that the blue pill, not the ailment it's meant to treat, is the cause of her sickness and suffering. And so begins the transformation, Linda's transformation. The wheels are set in motion, and the events and circumstances that follow are going to come together to create a monster.
Now, it's entirely possible that she's right about this doctor, that he's a quack doling out fake remedies to the children of a rich man in order to make a quick buck. But it's also possible that this blue pill really is doing more harm than good for Linda and her siblings. But whether her paranoia is warranted or not, the result is the same. Linda develops an almost pathological mistrust of doctors and mainstream medicine. She decides that if she's going to find a cure, it's going to come from someone other than a doctor.
And that early cure? Starvation, of course. You might remember our episode about Bernard McFadden, the fitness guru and magazine magnate who became enamored with the idea of fasting as a cure for disease. And while that's a different episode, and entirely fascinating on its own, McFadden's influence has somehow leaked outside of his dedicated episode, and into this one. It's the teachings of the fitness figures, and alternative medical practitioners like him, that get Linda's attention here, and convince her to try starvation on herself.
And, at least in Linda's recollection, it works. Long bouts of starvation, combined with regular enemas, allegedly cures Linda of her intestinal issues around 1889, by the time she's 22. From that point on, she's convinced. She converts into a zealot for the cause of starvation. She's obsessed. But it's her thing, and no one realizes just yet how deadly this conversion is going to be.
With a new outlook on life, Linda leaves home to make a career out of sharing the benefits of starvation with the rest of the world. The only problem? Linda, in her early 20s, is married to a man named Edwin Perry, and they have two young children together, Roland and Nina. It's a circumstance that, especially at that time, at the turn of the 20th century, would normally preclude her from pursuing a career of her own. But in 1898, after her 32nd birthday, Linda leaves her family behind, abandoning them for Minneapolis to make a name for herself as an osteopath and practitioner of alternative medicine.
This is an important mile marker for Linda. You know, was she a con woman or a true believer? Imagine what it would take to abandon your family, to leave two young children behind. How could she be okay with that? Was she really? The easy explanation would be to say that Linda is simply a cold, unfeeling sociopath who doesn't believe in remorse. But can it be that simple?
On one hand, Linda's been through a lot already. Childhood illness, tons of doctor's visits, taking medication against her will, then finding relief in the unlikeliest of places. Wouldn't you also feel compelled to share that with the world? Maybe this is more complicated than a greedy, detached individual seeking fame and fortune. Maybe this is a woman who really wants to help others and who's willing to give up everything to do it.
As Linda watches her two young children sleep soundly in their beds one last time, she takes a deep breath. There are diseases to be cured, people to be saved, a career to be had. And with that, she picks up her suitcase and leaves before the sun rises.
Hey everyone, Jason and Carissa here.
If you're enjoying Scoundrel, History's Forgotten Villains, we would really appreciate it if you left us a rating and review.
Also, we'd love your feedback.
Go to castmedia.com/scoundrelfeedback and answer our survey.
Thanks. Today's episode is sponsored by The Jordan Harbinger Show. If you've not taken a listen to Jordan's show just yet, this is your time.
If you like high-quality, fascinating audio hosted by interesting people, The Jordan Harbinger Show is a great one to check out.
What doesn't it cover? Where does this show not go? I appreciate the variety and energy Jordan brings to his conversations. It feels like you're in the room.
Here's a couple episodes I recommend. One is Jordan's conversation with Neil deGrasse Tyson on cosmic perspectives on civilization. That's a big topic. And then, of course, there's the one with Luis Navia on 25 years inside the narco cartels. Buckle up.
Yeah, I still need to listen to that one.
You really should.
The cool thing about this show is that there's an episode for everyone. So no matter what you're into, the whole thing's about helping you become a more informed person so you can make your own decisions about the world.
It's not easy to interview people, but Jordan is such a natural, and it makes his show easy to listen to. You come away from every episode having learned something new or some type of advice to mull over.
You get pulled into it from the beginning. It's very well done.
We really enjoy this show, and we think you will as well. There's just so much here.
Check out jordanharbinger.com/start for some episode recommendations, or search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R-B as in boy. I-N as in Nancy, G-E-R, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Back in the day, people grew what they ate. Fresh vegetables and fruits were the core of their diet.
But we're all busier now. Now we eat pre-made, processed, fast food. It's easy stuff, but not very healthy.
Full disclosure here, neither of us gets the doctor-recommended 6 cups a day of veggies and fruits.
But let me tell you what I do take to help me stay healthy. Field of Greens.
Yeah. Field of Greens is packed with a full spectrum of essential vegetables and fruits, plus science-backed herbs and prebiotics.
This is exactly what I need to stay healthy.
Field of Greens works fast, too.
So you'll have more energy.
You'll look and feel healthier. It can even help you lose weight.
My next physical is coming up, and I'm actually looking forward to it.
That's saying something.
Yeah, my doc's going to compare my old lab work versus my new lab work, and I think neither of us are going to shudder this time.
She'll say you crushed it.
Exactly.
Join me and take Field of Greens, too. And to help you get started, I got you 15% off your first order.
And another 10% off when you subscribe for recurring orders. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use promo code SCOUNDREL.
That's fieldofgreens.com, promo code SCOUNDREL. Field of Greens, promo code SCOUNDREL. Linda opens her first clinic as an osteopathic nurse in Minneapolis, going by the name Dr. Perry, as she brings her alternative treatments to the masses and touts her fasting method as a kind of panacea to cure anything by, quote, ridding the body of toxins or eliminating imbalances. As a helpful tip for you listeners, if someone is selling you on a way to rid your body of toxins but can't name the toxins they're talking about, chances are pretty high that the only thing they want to rid you of is your money.
But Linda, or Dr. Perry, is prolific with her proselytizing. Over the course of her career, she will write 3 separate books and create quite a mythology around herself. She adds to her origin story the false narrative that her first husband died, that she arrived in Minneapolis with a broken heart and $15 to her name. Nobody ever questions it, and it bolsters her reputation.
Not only that, she genuinely seems to believe in her 3-pronged treatment approach, which includes fasting,
allowing the digestive system to rest and be cleansed while removing impurities from the body.
Enemas.
Painful daily enemas that sometimes go on for hours and involve, at times, more than 12 quarts of water.
And finally, massage.
As in, a violent massage that involves Linda slamming her fists into patients' foreheads, backs, and other areas.
It is certainly an extreme program, but in truth, it's not that far off from the kinds of things people like Bernard McFadden were pushing. Men who were gaining sometimes international renown as experts on health and fitness.
But then she kills her first patient. It's 1902, and Linda, now 35, has just finalized her divorce from Edwin. Though in court proceedings and papers, she claims he abandoned her, nearly everyone in their lives believes Edwin over Linda.
It's shortly after the official dissolution of her marriage that she finds a woman named Gertrude Young in her office in Minneapolis. Gertrude suffered a stroke in 1900 that left one arm and one leg limp and slack. And while doctors have managed to treat the pain from her paralysis, they have had far less luck in returning mobility to that side of Gertrude's body. She's beside herself and willing to try anything and everything to get her body back.
Dr. Perry is happy to oblige. She starts Gertrude on a course of 40 days without food and only small amounts of approved liquids, vegetable broths, strained juice, and occasionally water.
About a month in, a friend of Gertrude's, who's staying with her while she undergoes the treatment, finds her sweating, shaking, and vomiting thick bile in her bed. Dr. Perry is called immediately.
She orders the windows thrown open despite freezing temperatures outside and insists that Gertrude continue with the fasting treatment. But her visit does nothing to improve the woman's condition.
Gertrude's friend calls a different nurse who brings a physician named Dr. Williams. In fact, he's the one who treated Gertrude before she went to see Dr. Perry. He insists that Gertrude break her fast immediately and that no amount of starvation will cure her paralysis, and that continuing it will almost certainly lead to death.
But Linda, Dr. Perry, disagrees. She tells Gertrude she's almost there, that she's so close to the end, to relief and to recovery. And it's enough to convince Gertrude to continue the fast.
6 days later, Gertrude dies of starvation on the 39th day of her prescribed fast. Dr. Williams, as it turns out, is also the county coroner, and he opens up an inquiry into Gertrude's death, where it's determined that she died of starvation and was a victim of, as he calls it, cruel and unnecessary quackery at the hands of Dr. Perry.
Oh, and then there's this kicker. As officials are looking into what charges they might be able to bring against Dr. Perry, they discover that she's also in possession of all of Gertrude's expensive jewelry. She claims Gertrude gifted it all to one of her nurses, but the nurse Dr. Perry mentioned cannot be found, and officials wonder if this nurse even exists in the first place.
Linda immediately goes on the offensive. She claims that Gertrude didn't follow her instructions closely enough, and that she died at her own hands, that Linda has 18 other patients who made it through the treatment just fine, and that any physician questioning her methods is simply jealous of her success.
In the end, the inquest determines that Dr. Perry can't be charged with any crime.
But how? How could that possibly be when there's so much evidence to the contrary?
As it turns out, it's all due to a loophole in Minnesota law and the fact that Dr. Perry actually holds no legitimate medical license. Because she isn't licensed to practice medicine, she can't be held to the same standards of care that a real doctor would be in court.
And there's no law in Minnesota prohibiting her from using her starvation methods without a license, as long as her patients came to her willingly, which Gertrude Young tragically did. Authorities admit that Gertrude could have broken her fast at any time and sought care elsewhere prior to her death, but she chose not to. But it's hard not to see the other side of this argument, that Dr. Perry purposefully maintained her patients in a state too weak to understand what was happening to them. But we would be about 120 years too late in this case. Linda Burfield, Dr. Perry, is released of all legal liability and allowed to keep practicing.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Save big money when you start your next project today at Menards. Convert your current recessed lighting with energy-saving LED downlights from Fight Electric. They're bright and install easily in just minutes. They also go from regular lighting to nightlight mode with just a simple flip of a switch. Save big on all Fight lighting products now at Menards. Shop our lighting options today in-store and on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
It's a win for Linda, and it's not her only one. In this period of her life, she also falls in love with a man so different from her first husband, so different from any man she's ever been connected to, that she simply cannot take her mind off of him. This guy is Samuel Hazard, and he is the love of Linda's life.
A tall, handsome West Point graduate with a cosmopolitan flair, Samuel Hazard is the type of man that would turn heads on the street. And he certainly catches the attention of Dr. Perry. The two begin courting after her scandal over Gertrude Young. And in 1904, at the age of 37, Linda and Samuel tie the knot.
From rural Minnesota to here, it's quite the transformation. And finally, Linda has a man who matches her grand designs for her own life. Someone who seems willing and able to live out the luxurious and adventurous existence she wants.
There's just one problem. He's already married.
Almost as quickly as she escaped the Gertrude Young scandal, Dr. Linda Hazard, as she goes by these days, finds herself back in the public eye. Samuel is arrested and charged with bigamy. There's a woman named Viva claiming to be his second and very much still married wife. To top it all off, Viva insists that there's also a first wife in New York that he never divorced either.
It's through this trial that the rest of Samuel Hazard's dirty laundry sees the light of day. Apparently, he was kicked out of the military for embezzling money. He was a drunk and a gambler, a con man. Yet through it all, Linda remains at Samuel's side, and he does the same for her. Even when his second wife offers to drop the charges if he will simply return home, Samuel refuses. His marriage to Linda is what matters, and he's willing to go to jail for it.
Samuel is sentenced to 2 years in prison. And something like prison, it changes a person. From behind bars, Samuel reconnects with his second wife, Viva, and initially forbids Linda from visiting him. He and Viva make plans to reunite, to move to Nevada to be closer to his parents, to fix things between them. With her help, he has his other marriages dissolved and agrees to legally marry her upon his release.
This doesn't sit well with Linda. So after months of petitioning, Linda finally receives the green light. At last, Samuel has agreed to let Linda visit him in prison. It is not known what happens in this meeting, but it changes things for everyone. And in October 1905, Samuel is released from Stillwater Prison and walks straight to Dr. Linda Hazard's office and into her arms.
In 1906, there isn't much left for Linda, now 39, and Samuel in Minnesota. Both have seen their share of personal scandals and are looking for a place to begin anew. Linda has ambitious dreams of opening a grand sanatorium to peddle her treatments, but she needs to find a place with enough cheap land and somewhere far from her infamy.
She settles on a property in quaint Olalla, Washington, and names it Wilderness Heights. The West turns out to be the perfect place for Linda and Samuel to reinvigorate her business. People are coming in droves, seeking new opportunities, avoiding old enemies, and looking for a new way of life. Exactly the kind of patient Linda wants. Desperate people willing to try something new.
Desperate. That word has real meaning in this story because it's desperation that leads people to Linda Hazard's door. Imagine how these people must feel. How much pain they must be in, or how much fear they carry in the face of their own mortality, to seek out not just treatment that is obviously dangerous, but treatment from someone with a track record of killing people.
It's a testament to the lengths people will go to for some semblance of control over the unpredictable nature of health in the human body.
She publishes her first book in 1908, Fasting for the Cure of Disease, as a way to promote her treatments as a cure-all for everything from headaches to cancer.
The book legitimizes her, washes away the stench of what happened in Minnesota, and draws a whole new level of wealthy clientele. But it doesn't stop her from killing her patients.
In 1908, Dr. Hazard welcomes Daisy Maud Hagland to Wilderness Heights to treat her advanced stomach cancer. She puts her on a classic three-pronged treatment regimen of starvation, enemas, and massage.
And Daisy dies shortly afterwards. No one suspects Linda, however, as her patient was already unable to eat due to her stomach cancer, and many say she likely would have starved to death anyway. Daisy leaves behind her son, Ivar, who coincidentally goes on to open Ivar's, a well-known seafood restaurant chain in the region.
Then there's Ida Wilcox, and Blanche Tyndall, and Viola Heaton.
And Ivan Flux, a rich Englishman who comes to the United States to buy a ranch and winds up in Dr. Hazard's care. He fasts for 53 days straight before dying and, strangely, leaves all of his wealth and assets to Dr. Hazard in his will. She tells his family back in England that he died alone, with only $70 to his name.
And then there's L.E. Rader, a successful local politician who seeks out treatment for a rather benign stomach issue. Dr. Hazard puts him on a 29-day fast. A health inspector actually happens upon Rader at Wilderness Heights while Linda is out making a house call. The inspector implores Rader to leave at once, but upon returning, Linda whisks him away to a secret secondary location to finish his treatment. He dies shortly after, nearly 6 feet tall, but somehow weighing less than 100 pounds.
These deaths don't go unnoticed. They're reported and investigated. When authorities perform autopsies, they unilaterally find that every patient died from starvation. When Linda does the autopsies, her causes of death are, well, anything else she can conveniently blame it on. The spotlight leads to Wilderness Heights coming to be known by a new name around town, Starvation Heights.
But again, Linda is saved by a loophole in the law. Despite having no medical degree, she's grandfathered into a medical license by a statute that provides special exceptions for those practicing alternative medicine. It's a stretch to consider what she does alternative medicine, but it holds up in court nonetheless.
Between 1908 and 1912, Dr. Linda Hazard treats dozens, if not hundreds, of patients at Wilderness Heights. And while the exact number still isn't known, and likely cannot ever be known, at least 13 deaths are attributed to her extreme starvation treatments.
With the notable exception of one patient, Eugene Stanley Wakelin. He's found on Hazard's property with a single gunshot wound to the head.
The death is quickly ruled a suicide, but some strange coincidences are discovered later.
Like this. Shortly after signing on as one of Dr. Hazard's patients, Wakelin transfers power of attorney over to her. She sends correspondence to Wakelin's lawyer requesting money, but he replies with the news that despite his nobility, Wakelin has no money to give.
He's found shot to death not long after that. Many of Linda's victims are like Wakelin, wealthy individuals somehow distanced from their families for one reason or another, whose belongings and fortunes always seem to inexplicably land in the coffers of Linda and Samuel.
It must be nice to have patients who so adore you as a medical professional that they leave you their entire estates, even after they die in your care.
Like British heiress Claire Williamson, this one's different, though, because Claire is where Linda's streak of outrunning her consequences will come to an end.
1910. Linda Hazard is now 43 years old. Dorothy and Claire Williamson are two wealthy heiresses from Australia, the orphaned daughters of a well-to-do English officer in the Imperial Army Medical Services. While visiting Vancouver, British Columbia, they happen upon Linda's book.
Dorothea and Claire are known among family and friends for a predisposition toward hypochondria. And while neither of them suffers from any life-threatening illnesses, they both have mild indigestion issues. And Claire has a slightly dropped uterus.
They become fascinated by Linda Hazard's treatments and what it might do for their medley of minor ailments. Already vegetarians with a mistrust for modern medicine, the prospect of finding well-being without traditional doctors or drugs is intriguing.
It's simple, the way Dr. Linda Hazard describes it in her book. Overeating, she writes, is the vice of the whole human race. They begin corresponding with Linda and start some of her treatments in their hotel in Vancouver. But as the letters arrive and cut to the chase, the only way for Linda to really be able to treat them is after an in-person examination.
So, without telling anyone, Dorothea and Claire travel from Vancouver to Seattle to seek the doctor's care.
Official treatment begins in a Seattle hotel. It's the same three-pronged approach we've seen time and time again already. Starvation, enemas, violent massages. The treatment affects them as we would expect. Dorothea and Claire lose weight rapidly, become weak and sallow. And while none of it seems to help their initial symptoms, they remain dedicated to the process and dedicated to Linda.
After about 29 days, the two sisters are transported from their Seattle hotel to Wilderness Heights for more intensive care. They're so weak at this point that they're moved by stretcher and ambulance.
Linda stores the women's jewelry and the deeds to their real estate in her personal safe, for safekeeping, of course. She also has them sign over a monthly stipend to pay for their housing and treatment, as well as instructions regarding what to do with their remains should they not survive.
It's at this point that Claire and Dorothea Williamson become more like prisoners than patients. Too weak to protest or object, they're barred from communicating with their family as they continue to undergo Dr. Hazard's starvation treatments. It becomes clear at this point to Dorothea that unless they do something drastic, they will die in this place.
But even in her weakened state, Claire is willing to do something drastic if it means saving herself and her dear sister. She manages to put together a cablegram to be sent to the girl's old governess in Australia, a woman named Margaret Conway. The initial cablegram is short and troubling.
Come, SS Marama, May 8th, first class, Claire.
At first, Margaret assumes Claire is alerting her that she and Dorothea will be arriving back in Australia on May 8th. But something nags at her about the cablegram. Claire has never been the type to flaunt her wealth. Mentioning first class in the cablegram is so unlike her. So Margaret calls the steamship company when she learns of another strange twist. The SS Marama isn't sailing to Sydney on May 8th. It's sailing from Sydney to British Columbia. Claire wants Margaret to come to them, but why?
When the Marama reaches Honolulu, Margaret receives a letter from Claire in the care of a woman named Linda Burfield Hazard in Seattle that explains more and troubles her more.
In the letter, Claire writes profusely about Dr. Hazard and her husband Samuel and their miraculous treatments. But something is unnerving about it. Her handwriting is ragged, sloppy, far from the practiced, perfect handwriting Claire has been taught.
She mentions that Dorothea is suffering from a serious mental breakdown, but that Dr. Hazard has taken wonderful care of them both. She alludes that there is more to the story, but that she must tell the rest of it when she arrives in person.
Margaret is beside herself with worry. Dorothea was always nervous, but never had any real mental health issues. And this only increases her anxiety over getting to the girls as quickly as possible. The only relief she has is the 15-day span between the letter and the cablegram that follows it, mentioning that both sisters are quite well. Perhaps Dorothea has taken a turn for the better.
When Margaret arrives in Vancouver, however, she learns the tragic truth. Samuel Hazard is waiting for her, and he brings devastating news. He sits Margaret down and tells her,
"Miss Claire has died, and Miss Dora is helplessly insane. I am sorry."
"I'm sorry?" That's all Samuel has to say? And all Margaret can do is sit and cry for the girls who were not her blood, but who she raised and loved all the same. All this time, she was coming to save them when Claire had already died and Dorothea had already lost her mind. Margaret accompanies Samuel to Wilderness Heights, where she finally meets Dr. Linda Hazard.
There is little sympathy in her voice as she commands the space in her office. She explains away all the reasons for Claire's untimely death. Her liver was cirrhotic, too tough to even penetrate with a knife, she says. Her blood was dry enough to turn to dust in her fingers. Her intestines were too small to fit a pencil through. It's a lot for Margaret to bear, and she reaches for a pad to write it all down. The family will certainly ask for details.
That's when Margaret notices the pad on Dr. Hazard's desk is a blue journal that once belonged to Claire. Then, Linda asks if she'd like to see Claire's body, and Margaret blanches. How does she still have the body?
Linda turns to her, almost smiling, and says, "Yes, I have her beautifully embalmed.
Embalming is still a new process in 1911, and it's not something that Claire had ever expressed interest in, which leaves Margaret all the more suspicious of this woman behind the desk. The body she's shown looks nothing like Claire. This figure was less than 50 pounds when she died, a ghost even before she left.
And there it is. That nagging feeling that she's had ever since that initial cablegram arrived comes to a head as she finally sees Dorothea in her cabin on the property. The cabin is no bigger than a chicken coop, with one panelless window and a roughly fashioned plank door. Margaret enters and finds Dorothea little more than a living skeleton. She scoops her into her arms as the woman weakly acknowledges her presence.
It was ghastly. Just ghastly.
Margaret will later explain about that first encounter.
I was looking at a death's head, a skull with skin drawn tightly over the bones. Over it all was a bluish tint.
And in a raspy, weak voice, Dorothea mutters the same phrase over and over, desperate. You have the power to take me away, haven't you? Tootie, a nickname for Margaret. You can take me away. Please.
In that moment, it's decided. Margaret could not save Claire, but she will save Dorothea.
Permitted to visit Dorothea often, Margaret sneaks food into the tomato broth she's being served and manages to send word to Claire and Dorothea's uncle in Portland, Oregon, John Herbert, who had already grown suspicious of the Hazards after learning of Claire's death. They confer on how and when to rescue Dorothea.
When suddenly, Dorothea changes her mind. Perhaps it's Linda's influence, or her already weakened state, but she adamantly refuses to leave, stating that she wants to finish her treatment. But the more Margaret learns about Linda Hazard and her sanatorium, the less she believes that Dorothea is acting of her own free will in a sound mind.
The sourest note of all comes when Margaret notices Linda Hazard wearing the late Claire's clothes and hats around the premises without a care in the world. Yet another patient who nobly left their worldly possessions to the doctor who tried so hard to save them, or, as Margaret sees it, a charlatan and murderer wearing her victim's clothes.
As Margaret and John Herbert work to formulate a plan, they learn that Dorothea has already given the Hazards power of attorney and that they had been quietly stealing her money throughout her stay at Wilderness Heights. Even more troubling is the revelation that Linda and Samuel have obtained legal guardianship over Dorothea, citing her mental incapability, and they refuse to let her leave with John and Margaret.
At least, not without payment. In what can only be seen as a ransom, Linda Hazard and Samuel Hazard allow John and Margaret to take custody of Dorothea for the price of $2,000. Just around $60,000 in today's money. The two of them are appalled. What doctor goes to these lengths to keep a patient, only to sell them off to the highest bidder?
After intense negotiations, John Herbert pays an amount. The exact number is not known, and Dorothea is free.
John Herbert, Margaret, and Dorothea immediately go to the authorities in Tacoma County to tell them about the atrocities being committed over at Wilderness Heights. And it isn't that the police don't know about it. Remember, the deaths of Linda Hazard's patients have already been widely reported on. But the county simply doesn't have the money to investigate all the allegations.
Until Dorothea recovers. When she does, Dorothea is charged by a sense of injustice for her sister, for herself. And she offers not only to testify on the prosecution's behalf as a star witness, but to fund the investigation herself. She barely escaped Linda Hazard. She will not let others face the same fate.
And in August 1911, Linda Hazard finally faces justice. Police arrive at Wilderness Heights. They find several patients also near death, and Linda inside. They take Linda Hazard into custody, and the county prepares to go to trial, charging her with manslaughter in the death of Claire Williamson.
In court, Linda shows no remorse and no shortage of excuses and theatrics. She claims she's being persecuted because she's a woman, because she's better than all her male colleagues. She claims that Margaret Conway and John Herbert's claims are false, just the ramblings of grieved family members who can't deal with the reality that their loved one is dead and that Claire chose to go to her instead of them.
She's fiery. She's passionate in her defense of herself and her methods. Her staff and personal circle close ranks around her, defending her, testifying to her character, saying anything they can to make her appear innocent.
But the prosecution's case is better, and Dorothea is their star witness. The jury finds her guilty of manslaughter in the death of Claire Williamson.
But even as she awaits her sentence, Linda Hazard doesn't stop working. People don't stop coming to her for treatment. In the time it takes the judge to decide on the length of Linda's sentence, two more of her patients will die. Eventually, she receives 20 years in prison in Walla Walla.
Well, 1 to 20 years. She's released after just 2 in 1915 at the age of 48. And she and Samuel strike a deal with the governor of Washington. She's given a full pardon if she agrees to leave the United States. They decide that New Zealand is the place for them. So, just as they had when they left Minnesota, they take off for new lands and new opportunities.
But it's the same old stuff from Dr. Linda Burfield Hazard. She publishes another book on fasting, opens yet another clinic in New Zealand as a dietitian and osteopath, and continues treating patients with the same deadly programs she used in Washington.
She also becomes incredibly wealthy during her time in New Zealand, and it seems like she's yet again going to skirt the consequences.
Until 1917, when a newspaper in Whanganui, New Zealand, finds out that Dr. Hazard is practicing medicine without a license. And unlike Minnesota and Washington, there's no loophole here that protects her from the law. She's charged in Auckland under the Medical Practitioners Act for, quote, practicing medicine while not registered to do so, and quickly found guilty.
Unfortunately for her victims, the sentence for this crime in New Zealand at the time is a fine of just £5, about $462.13 in U.S. dollars. It's nothing for a published and working osteopath. But Linda sees the writing on the wall. Her opportunities are drying up, and she needs to find greener pastures. Plus, her heart is calling her back to where she really feels she belongs.
She returns to Olalla. There, she opens up a new sanatorium, conveniently called a, quote, school of health, since technically, Linda's medical license was canceled by the state of Washington after her manslaughter conviction. It doesn't slow her down at all, though. She continues to treat patients and oversee their fasting regimens. The new building's equipped with treatment rooms, as well as an autopsy room in the basement. Because, of course, what school of health doesn't need its own room for autopsies?
All in all, 12 more people will die at this new school of health from Linda Hazard's starvation tactics. It seems nothing will stop her.
Except fate. In 1935, the School of Health burns to the ground. Linda, now 67, does not have the funds to recoup her loss, and the school is never rebuilt. Then, in 1938, 70-year-old Linda Burfield Hazard falls ill, complaining of a series of maladies for several months. And this is perhaps the strangest part of her sordid story. Linda, this woman who so clearly played the role of con woman and huckster her entire life, decides to undergo one of her own fasting treatments to cure herself.
Even though she knows what the treatment will do, she's seen at least 18 of her patients die from this, and likely as high as 40. So why do it? Is it to prove a point? Stubbornness? Arrogance? Does she need to stick to her story so adamantly that she'll die over it? Maybe she wanted so badly to stick it to traditional medicine that she refused to let them in, even when they likely would have saved her life.
Or is she truly a martyr for her own twisted cause? Does she really believe that her methods work and that her victims were merely too weak-willed to use them properly?
As is often the case, we don't get a clear answer. Linda Burfield Hazard dies at the age of 70 as a result of starvation and exhaustion.
What do we take from this story? What lesson can we learn from such a complicated, despicable woman? We find this one particularly difficult to make sense of because, in truth, Linda Hazard's behavior betrays split motivation. She was callous and avaricious, swindling dying patients out of their fortunes, their estates, out of the literal clothes off their backs.
And she was a true believer, a woman who put her faith so deeply into her own methods that she was willing to die for them. Did she see her victims as she wasted away herself in those final moments? Was there ever a shred of remorse, a realization of just how many lives she ruined?
Or did Linda believe until the very end that she knew better than all of them? Who knows? But perhaps things might have unfolded differently, if only, as a child, she had never been given that little blue pill.
Scoundrel, History's Forgotten Villains, is executive produced by Jason and Carissa Weiser and Colin Thompson.
Today's episode was written by Jeremy Novick. It's produced by DJ Lubell and edited and sound designed by Anton Doty.
Scoundrel, History's Forgotten Villains, is a Cast original podcast.
Hey everyone, Jason and Carissa here.
If you're enjoying Scoundrel, History's Forgotten Villains, we would really appreciate it if you left us a rating and review.
Also, we'd love your feedback.
Go to castmedia.com/scoundrelfeedback and answer our survey.
Thanks.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.